Interesting. Could you put the... Here's the magic of technology. There it is, you see. You know, every morning when I wake up, I try and have the same sort of two thoughts, which my wife tells me is impossible because I'm a male, so I can't have two boxes open at one time. But I do try and have two thoughts. And my first thought, I try to make it, is this the day the Lord is coming back? That's a great thought to have first thing in the morning. And then my second thought is, make this the best day of the rest of your life. In other words, what can I do to please the Lord? Always good thoughts to have. And when you look at those thoughts, you come to a book like Romans. And when we look at the value of Scripture, when we look at what has been written, then you turn to some of the great pillars of faith and you look at why would we study Romans? Listen to what Griffith Thomas wrote. He said, "The reading of Romans is one of the most rewarding experiences in the life of a Christian. This is not to say that it should be read as a magazine article that is put aside and dismissed from the mind. The continual reading of this epistle brings a stream of benefits to the believer. The investment of a great amount of time pays handsome dividends on the spiritual market. The epistle should be studied with all possible intellectual attention and concentration. It is important that the whole epistle should be read right through in one sitting, and this should be done, if possible, day by day for a month." There's a challenge right at the outset. "It should be studied with earnest prayer and personal trust. Intellectual attention is insufficient. The epistle should be regarded as a personal letter to ourselves. This is the epistle that changed Martin Luther and brought to pass the Protestant Reformation. It is not strange that Luther expressed his mind in such strong language. It is the true masterpiece of the New Testament and the very purest gospel, which is well worthy and deserving that a Christian should not only learn it by heart, word for word, but also that he should daily deal with it as the daily bread of the soul. It brings forth understanding, the basic facts of salvation, unusual conviction about matters pertaining to life and usefulness in Christian service. Martin Luther said, this epistle is really the chief part of the New Testament and the very purest gospel, and is worthy not only that every Christian should know it word for word, but occupy himself with it every day. It can never be read or pondered too much, and the more it is dealt with, the more precious it becomes and the better it tastes. William Tyndale, I think it meet that every Christian man not only knows it by rote and without the book, but also exercise himself therein evermore continually, as with the daily bread of the soul. No man verily can read it too often or study it too well, for the more it is studied, the easier it is, the more it is chewed, the pleasanter it is, and the more groundly it is searched, the preciousest things are found in it. And finally, Oswald Chambers said this, sin is something I am born with and cannot touch. Only God touches sin through redemption. It is through the cross of Christ that God redeemed the entire human race from the possibility of damnation through the heredity of sin. God nowhere holds a person responsible for having the heredity of sin and does not condemn anyone because of it. Condemnation comes when I realize that Jesus Christ came to deliver me from this heredity of sin, and yet I refuse to let him do so. From that moment, I begin to get the seal of damnation. This is the condemnation, that the light has come into the world and men loved darkness rather than light." Oswald Chambers. So you see, what we have before us is a study of a book which many of the great writers and great theologians have said is one of the finest examples of writing with the most pure instruction, something that we should read and heed. It is a wonderful book. In order for us to start into this book, I thought one of the ways to introduce it would be to have a look at two things. First of all, the writer of the book is Paul, and secondly, it was written to the Romans. So perhaps it would help us a little bit on our journey as we look at those two things. First of all, let's think about Rome. Let's think about Rome. You see, Rome was a huge city, and the Roman Empire was huge. Can I magically get the next slide? There it is. Look at that. That is the growth of the Roman Empire in the first century. It expanded from the lighter colors. You see the darker areas? That was the expansion in the first century. It is a huge empire. The city of Rome itself, around about the time of Paul, and depending on who you read, had certainly a minimum of 1 million inhabitants and up to possibly 4 million. That is a huge city. It is a huge city. And when you look at this, it's a cosmopolitan place. There were Greeks, Syrians, Jews, North Africans, Spaniards, Gauls, Britons, all living there, all coming to the city. Can you do the next one? Now, if you visited Rome, you may have seen something that looks a little like this. I've never been to Rome, but what you see are the ruins. And you get a sense of the grandeur of Rome, but it's very difficult when you see the ruins. What you can do, though, is you can get a sense of the size and the scope. There's an online man who is an architect who spent years and years and years recreating Rome in all its detail, a full-size scale model. Can you do the next picture? And it looks kind of like that. When you fill things in, you get a sense of the size of Rome. Next slide. Draw back even further, the arena, the Colosseum, but look at the city stretching out. Next slide. The important slide, the purpose. You see, Rome was a crowded place. Many people moved to the city to get jobs. The work that they sought often wasn't there. This is going to sound very familiar when you think about present day. And there was an epidemic of homeless inhabitants. The work available was difficult to obtain. Slaves performed most of the menial jobs. Interestingly, some of the professions were performed by slaves, even teachers and surgeons and architects. Most of the freedmen worked at various trades, bakers, fishmongers, and carpenters. Most of the Roman tenement blocks, they had apartment blocks. And in the Rome of 50 AD, some of the streets were only 6 feet wide. That's not very wide at all. Space was at a premium. It was a walled metropolis, and little attention was paid to housing needs. And the crowding was such that when you start thinking of running water and bathroom and food and all those things, if you lived on the ground floor, you had a chance to get running water, but also the fear of flooding. And then above you, people would just offload all of their old dirty food and the latrines, everything would be poured out into the street. Doesn't make a very pretty picture, does it? That's why the majority of the wealthy people lived up on the hills, the seven hills of Rome, most notably around the Palatine Hill. The flats were reserved for the apartments, and these were sometimes 5 to 7 stories in height. There were many, many accidents, many instances. Poverty throughout the city was apparent. and it would be seen by your manner, the lack of dress. Even the floor on which you lived depended on your income. The higher floors, where rent was paid for by the day or week, were cramped with often one room to a family. Running water was at a premium. On the contrary, most wealthy residents, those who didn't live in villas outside the city, lived in a domus. These homes in Rome were usually located on the hills, particularly the Palatine Hill, close to the imperial palace. Behind the dwelling, you would have a shop, would be there. You'd go through a front, there'd be a shop, and then behind that shop would be the dwelling place. There would be an opening in the atrium, and water, when it rained, would come through and go into a pool, which was collected and used elsewhere in the house. There were bedrooms and libraries and offices, all the trappings of wealth. Regardless of whether rich or poor, tenement or villa, the social unit throughout the empire was family. And the male head of the household had the power of life and death over all members of the family. And this is a bit that I found hard to digest. He could reject children if they were disfigured, if he questioned their paternity, if he had more than one daughter already, or merely if he felt so inclined. He could sell them into slavery. Gradually over time, this all-powerful control over the family would diminish, but it was an ironclad rule that the husband or father did not limit the power of the woman of the house. The home was the domain of the wife. She was restricted from appearing in public, but she ran the household and saw to the education of the children until a tutor could be found. And by the time, at the end of the empire, in the 300s, she was actually permitted to sit with her husband at dinner, go to the baths, although not at the same time as the men, and attend the theatre and games. So you get the sense that in Rome, lots of crowding, slavery, lots of poverty, surrounded by areas of great wealth. You see, the affluent would spend the day between business and leisure. Most Romans worked a